He told her his name was Emmanuel. Smart, who had a soft spot for the destitute, particularly those as pious as Emmanuel slash Mitchell appeared to be, gave the robed holy man a $5 bill and offered him employment doing odd jobs around her lavish Salt Lake City home. Thus, in November 2001, did Mitchell end up working half a day at the Smart residence, helping Lois's husband, Ed Smart, patch their roof and rake leaves in their yard. During the 5 hours he spent on the $1.1 million property, Mitchell met the Smart's 14-year-old daughter, Elizabeth, and became infatuated with her angelic features and innocent demeanor. He decided that God intended her to be his polygamous wife. Over the months that followed, Mitchell obsessively stalked Elizabeth, spying on her from the lower slopes of the Wasatch Range, which rises directly above the Smart's affluent Federal Heights neighborhood. Around 2 in the morning on June 5th, 2002, Mitchell placed a chair beneath a small window that had been left ajar on the first floor, sliced through a flimsy screen, and squeezed through the opening into the Smart's kitchen. Making his way through the vast 6,600-square-foot house, he located the upstairs bedroom Elizabeth shared with her 9-year-old sister, Mary Catherine, and woke Elizabeth. Unbeknownst to Mitchell, he also woke Mary Catherine. Feigning sleep, the younger girl stole a furtive glimpse at the intruder in the darkness and heard him threaten her sister. After telling Elizabeth to put on some shoes, Mitchell hustled her past the bedroom where the Smart parents were sleeping soundly and exited the house. Mitchell marched Elizabeth at knife point 4 miles into the foothills west of her home. Upon reaching a secluded campsite in Dry Creek Canyon, he and Barzee conducted a weird, self-styled wedding ritual to seal the girl to Mitchell in the new and everlasting covenant, a Mormon euphemism for polygamous marriage. Barzee then demanded that Elizabeth remove her red pajamas. When the girl balked, Barzee explained that if she refused to cooperate, Mitchell would forcibly disrobe her. Faced with this prospect, Elizabeth complied, whereupon Mitchell consummated the marriage by raping his 14-year-old bride. Back in the Smart household, Sister Mary Catherine had remained in her bed, too terrified by what she'd witnessed to get up and alert her parents. At least 2 hours passed before she finally summoned the courage to go to their bedroom and wake them. Horrified and trying to comprehend how his eldest daughter could have been snatched from her own bed, Ed Smart, even before he called the police, phoned the president of his local LDS stake, who in turn mobilized a search party of trusted saints. Searchers immediately began combing the neighborhood for Elizabeth, but found no sign of her. For at least 2 months after her abduction, Elizabeth was held at a series of campsites hidden in a labyrinth of scrub-choked ravines above her home, close enough to hear would-be rescuers calling her name. Sometimes she was kept in a subterranean hollow covered with a lean-to. On other occasions, her ankle was chained to a tree. Using his gift for fundamentalist rhetoric and adroitly manipulating the religious indoctrination Elizabeth had received since she was old enough to talk, Mitchell cowed the girl into becoming an utterly submissive polygamous concubine, buttressing his powers of theological persuasion with threats to kill her and her family. Raised to obey figures of Mormon authority unquestioningly and to believe that LDS doctrine is the law of God, she would have been particularly susceptible to the dexterous fundamentalist spin Mitchell applied to familiar Mormon scripture. The white robes Mitchell and Barzee wore, and forced Elizabeth to wear, resembled the sacred robes she had donned with her family when they entered the Mormon temple. When Mitchell bullied Elizabeth into submitting to his carnal demands, he used the words of Joseph Smith, words she had been taught were handed down by God himself, to phrase those demands. "Being brought up as she was made her especially vulnerable," says Debbie Palmer, who is intimately acquainted with the coercive power of fundamentalist culture from her own upbringing in Bountiful. Mitchell would never have been able to have such power over a non-Mormon girl. Once he'd gained psychological control of Elizabeth, Mitchell felt sufficiently confident that she wouldn't flee or try to alert the police that he often took her to public places, albeit with her blonde braids covered in a headscarf and her face hidden behind a burqa-like veil. In September, Mitchell even brought Elizabeth, thus disguised, to a lively, beer-fueled party in downtown Salt Lake, attended by more than 100 revelers, most of whom were not particularly pious, where she was photographed by one partygoer but not recognized. On at least one occasion while Elizabeth was under Mitchell's control, according to one of her uncles, for the better part of a day Mitchell left the girl completely by herself, but she didn't try to run away. On July 24th, acting with customary brazenness, Mitchell attempted to kidnap a 15-year-old cousin of Elizabeth's. Resorting to the same method he'd used previously, Mitchell placed a chair beneath an open window, cut through its screen with his knife, and was preparing to crawl into the girl's home when he inadvertently knocked some framed pictures onto the floor, creating a racket that woke up the household and caused him to flee. Because the police were convinced at the time that they already had the prime suspect in custody, another former laborer for the Smarts, Richard Ricci, who had a fishy alibi and a voluminous criminal history going back 30 years, it didn't occur to the cops that the sliced screen and chair left at the scene of this attempted break-in were significant clues. They failed to give serious consideration to the possibility that Elizabeth's abductor might be someone other than Ricci and might still be on the loose, attempting to kidnap other girls. Late one night in October, Mary Catherine, the younger sister who was the only outside witness to the crime, abruptly told Ed Smart, "Dad, I think I know who it is." She was pretty sure that the person she had seen abducting Elizabeth was the small, bearded man who had helped fix the roof, the self-proclaimed prophet who had called himself Emmanuel. Smart reported his daughter's belated disclosure to the Salt Lake City police, but because Mary Catherine had waited 4 months to identify the perpetrator, detectives didn't give it much credence. They nevertheless worked with the Smart family to produce 3 composite sketches of Emmanuel, based on their hazy memories of what he had looked like when he'd worked around their house in November 2001. The Smarts thought the last of these renderings was a reasonable likeness and wanted to go public with it, but the cops refused, arguing that it wasn't accurate enough and would only inundate them with false leads. Besides, they still thought Ricci, who had died in jail on August 27th of a brain hemorrhage, was the culprit. Frustrated, the Smarts took matters into their own hands. In early February 2003, they held a press conference during which they released the best police sketch to the public. Soon thereafter, a woman who saw the composite drawing called to report that it bore a resemblance to her brother, a man of strong religious views named Brian David Mitchell, who referred to himself as Emmanuel. She sent in a photo of Mitchell, which on February 15th was broadcast on the television show America's Most Wanted, along with photos and videotape of Elizabeth and footage of Ed Smart pleading with viewers to help find his daughter. On March 12th, 2003, an alert motorist who had watched the America's Most Wanted segment spotted someone who resembled Mitchell in the suburb of Sandy walking down State Street, a busy 6-lane thoroughfare that is one of the main north-south arterials in Salt Lake County. The Mitchell lookalike was dressed in seedy robes and sandals and was accompanied by a middle-aged woman and a teenage girl who were similarly attired. The motorist dialed 911. A pair of police officers, Karen Jones and Troy Rasmussen, pulled up in a squad car and stopped the oddly dressed trio. The man, who had a bushy salt-and-pepper beard and wore flowers in his unkempt hair, gave his name as Peter Marshall and insisted on speaking for the 2 females, who were wearing sunglasses and cheap gray wigs in an apparent attempt to disguise their identities. When questioned directly, the teenager denied that she was Elizabeth Smart, adamantly maintaining that her name was Augustine Marshall. She said she was 18 years old and that the man with the beard was her father. She seemed extremely reluctant to say or do anything without his consent. Officer Jones took the girl aside and questioned her further, but Augustine continued to be evasive and uncooperative. When Officer Rasmussen asked her why she was wearing a wig, she became angry, he told NBC News. "Told me that was personal, none of my business." The cops nevertheless persisted in asking if she was Elizabeth Smart, and after 45 minutes of grilling, the teen finally relented. On the brink of tears, she conceded her true identity with a biblical utterance. "Thou sayest," Jesus' reply to Pilate when asked if he was King of the Jews. even after she had revealed that she was indeed Elizabeth and was sitting in the back of the squad car on her way to be reunited with her father at the police station, she continued to express concern for the well-being of Mitchell and Barzee. "The first question out of her mouth," said Officer Jones, "was, 'What's going to happen to them? Are they going to be okay?' Didn't want them in trouble, didn't want them to be hurt." She started crying and cried all the way to the department. Many have wondered how Brian David Mitchell managed to exert such power over the girl, and why during the 9 months Elizabeth was his captive, she apparently made no effort to escape. But Julie Adkisson, a young Mormon woman who became acquainted with Mitchell 17 months before he kidnapped Elizabeth Smart, has no difficulty comprehending how Elizabeth came under his sway. Adkisson was 20 years old and selling shoes at Salt Lake City's Fashion Place Mall when she met Mitchell, who expressed an avid interest in sandals and began telling her about the intimate chats he regularly had with God. Not long thereafter, Mitchell handed her a written marriage proposal explaining that the Lord wished for her to become his plural wife. Adkisson declined the invitation to become betrothed to Mitchell, but continued to meet with him. Once she sat with him in a city park for more than 5 hours, mesmerized as he held forth on Mormon theology. She felt strangely drawn to Mitchell, she told Newsweek magazine, because everything he said was stuff I was raised on. I wanted to leave for hours, but I just sat there. Had she been as young and impressionable as Elizabeth Smart, Adkisson admitted, there is no telling what I would have done. Considering the traumas to which she was subjected as Mitchell's captive, Elizabeth appeared to be recovering with surprising grace after being rescued, according to those close to her. Although Elizabeth's father cautioned that she faced a long road back, he said that she was faring remarkably well since rejoining her family. David Hamblin, the bishop of the Smarts LDS ward, pronounced that despite what Mitchell may have done to her, Elizabeth remained pure before the Lord. From his prison cell, Dan Lafferty speculates that Elizabeth will be fine after a couple of months or so. But he regards Elizabeth's tribulations from a perspective not far removed from that of her tormentor, one of a religious zealot with whom, after all, Lafferty has much in common. After averring that he was happily shocked when I heard that she had been found and that she was alive, Lafferty opines that Elizabeth has had a very eye-opening experience, one that will prevent her from ever viewing her life in the same way as before. Disquietingly, he sees this as a blessing rather than something to mourn. As for Brian David Mitchell, in the days following his arrest, he steadfastly insisted that he had done nothing wrong, arguing that forcing a 14-year-old girl into polygamous bondage was not a criminal act because it was a call from God. Speaking through an attorney, he explained that Elizabeth was still his wife, and he still loves her and knows that she still loves him. Dan Lafferty was not the first person to surmise that Mitchell was a Mormon fundamentalist who kidnapped Elizabeth Smart in order to make her a plural wife. Immediately after she was abducted, 9 months before Lafferty made the same speculative leap, a resident of Phoenix, Arizona, named Flora Jessup, emailed a statement to the media hypothesizing that Elizabeth had been kidnapped by a polygamist. Her conjecture, although based largely on gut instinct, was rooted in personal experience. Jessup grew up in Colorado City as one of 28 siblings in a polygamous family. When she was 14, she filed sexual abuse charges against the family patriarch, her fundamentalist father, but the judge presumed she was lying and dismissed the case, after which leaders of the FLDS church confined her in the home of a relative for 2 years. A defiant, strong-willed girl, she created so much trouble for her keepers that when she was 16, church authorities gave her a choice. "They told me I had to either marry this guy they'd picked for me, one of my dad's brother's sons, or be committed to the state mental hospital," says Jessup. She opted for the arranged marriage and then fled both the marriage and Colorado City at the first opportunity. Now 34, she's an anti-polygamy activist and has founded an organization called Help the Child Brides. Jessup is extremely relieved that Elizabeth Smart was discovered alive and thinks the outpouring of support Elizabeth has received is wonderful. But in Jessup's view, it underscores the disturbing absence of support for another young victim of polygamy. her sister, Ruby Jessup, whose predicament she first brought to the attention of government officials more than a year before Elizabeth was abducted. Ruby was 14 years old when she was observed innocently kissing a boy she fancied in Colorado City. For this unforgivable sin, she was immediately forced to marry an older member of her extended family, whom she despised, in a fundamentalist ceremony presided over by Warren Jeffs. Like Elizabeth, Ruby was raped immediately after the wedding ceremony, so brutally that she spent her wedding night hemorrhaging copious amounts of blood. Unlike Elizabeth, however, Ruby attempted to flee her coerced marriage, running to the home of a sympathetic brother where she thought she would find refuge. Lured away from her brother's house by false promises, in May 2001, Ruby was allegedly abducted by members of the FLDS Church and brought to the home of her stepfather, Fred Jessup, second counselor to the prophet, the same house where Flora Jessup had been confined 17 years earlier. Flora, who fled Colorado City on the day Ruby was born, May 3, 1986, called the county sheriff to report that her sister had been kidnapped. When a sheriff's deputy came to Colorado City to look into the supposed crime, he was told by leaders of the church that the girl was on vacation. The deputy accepted this unskeptically and departed. Flora, furious at this apparent dereliction of duty, redoubled her efforts to persuade someone in a position of state authority to take action on behalf of her little sister. A month later, thanks to Flora's agitation, FLDS members were compelled by the Utah Department of Child and Family Services to bring Ruby to nearby St. George and meet with a social worker. Interviewed in the intimidating presence of one of her alleged abductors, Ruby told the social worker that everything was fine and was promptly returned to members of the faith. 2 years after that, as a 16-year-old, she gave birth to a child. Despite Flora's ongoing efforts to rescue her, nobody outside of Colorado City has heard from Ruby since the summer of 2001. She has effectively vanished into the folds of the fundamentalist church. Anti-polygamy activist Lorna Craig, a colleague of Flora Jessup's, is baffled and outraged by Utah's indifferent treatment of Ruby, especially when compared to the colossal effort the state mustered to rescue Elizabeth Smart and prosecute her abductors. Craig notes that both Elizabeth and Ruby were 14 when they were kidnapped, raped, and kept captive by polygamous fanatics. The main difference in the girls' respective ordeals, she says, is that Elizabeth was brainwashed for 9 months, while Ruby had been brainwashed by polygamous fanatics since birth. Despite the similarity of their plights, Elizabeth's abusers were jailed and charged with sexual assault, aggravated burglary, and aggravated kidnapping. While Ruby, says Craig, was returned to her abusers, no real investigation was done, no charges were brought against anyone involved. The dissimilar outcomes are attributable, in Craig's view, to the fact that Ruby Jessup was born into a polygamous community that has been allowed to break state and federal laws with impunity for many decades. Craig points out that because the mayor, the police, and the judge in Colorado City, Hilldale, are themselves polygamists who are absolutely obedient to the prophet, there is nowhere for victims of abuse to turn. I would say that teaching a girl that her salvation depends on her having sexual relations with a married man is inherently destructive. Such relationships, Craig argues bitterly, should be considered a crime, not a religion. Chapter 5. The Second Great Awakening. The sober preacher trained in the dialectics of the seminary was rare west of the Appalachians. One found instead faith healers and circuit rider evangelists who stirred their audiences to paroxysms of religious frenzy. The revivals by their very excesses deadened a normal antipathy toward religious eccentricity. And these Pentecostal years, which coincided with Joseph Smith's adolescence and early manhood, were the most fertile in America's history for the sprouting of prophets. Fawn Brody, No Man Knows My History. Shortly after the rescue of Elizabeth Smart and the arrest of Brian David Mitchell, FBI agents discovered a 27-page booklet Mitchell had written 2 months before he abducted Elizabeth. Titled The Book of Emmanuel David Isaiah, it purported to be a divine manifesto as revealed to Emmanuel/Mitchell, announcing the inauguration of a new fundamentalist church, the Seven Diamonds Plus One, which would serve as a brilliant, shining diadem of truth. The tract identified Emmanuel / Mitchell as the One, Mighty and Strong, and proclaimed that God had ordained him to lead the new church, the true and living Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in its purified and exalted state. The Book of Emmanuel David Isaiah also explained that God had transferred the keys and powers and ordinances of the holy priesthood for the salvation of mankind through a succession of prophets. The booklet traced this divinely ordained lineage from Adam to Noah to Abraham to Moses to Jesus unto Joseph Smith, Jr., and from Joseph Smith, Jr. unto Emmanuel David Isaiah, and from Emmanuel David Isaiah unto the end of the earth. To comprehend Brian David Mitchell, or to comprehend Dan Lafferty or Tom Green, or the polygamous inhabitants of Bountiful in Colorado City, one must first understand the faith these people have in common, a faith that gives shape and purpose to every facet of their lives. And any such understanding must begin with the aforementioned Joseph Smith, Jr., the founder of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. More than a century and a half after his passing, the sheer force of Joseph's personality still holds extraordinary sway over Mormons and Mormon fundamentalists alike. "I admire Joseph Smith," affirms Dan Lafferty, his eyes burning. "I admire nobody else as much." Whether one believes that the faith he spawned is the world's only true religion or a preposterous fable, Joseph emerges from the fog of time as one of the most remarkable figures ever to have breathed American air. Whatever his lapses, Harold Bloom argues in The American Religion, Smith was an authentic religious genius, unique in our national history. In proportion to his importance and his complexity, he remains the least studied personage of an undiminished vitality in our entire national saga. Joseph was born on December 23, 1805, in the Green Mountains of Vermont. His father, Joseph Smith Sr., was a tenant farmer, perpetually on the lookout for his main chance, who had lost all his money a short while earlier in a failed scheme to export ginseng root to China. Finding himself broke and saddled with a crushing debt, Smith Pere was reduced to scraping out a meager living from a plot of rocky, barely cultivable farmland rented in ignominy from his father-in-law. New England was then in the midst of an extended economic depression, and penury dogged the Smith family throughout the childhood of Joseph Jr. Constantly searching for better prospects, the family moved 5 times during the boy's first 11 years before settling in Palmyra, a town of 4,000 in western New York beside the Erie Canal, which at that time was under construction. The canal was the most ambitious engineering venture of that era and had sparked a robust, if temporary, boom in the local economy. Joseph Sr. hoped to be a beneficiary of this uptick. Here is how the Smith clan is described upon their arrival in Palmyra in 1817, in a typically snide article about the budding prophet published in a local newspaper, The Reflector, on February 1, 1831, as Joseph's new religion began to make a splash. Joseph Smith Sr., the father of the personage of whom we are now writing, had by misfortune or otherwise been reduced to extreme poverty before he migrated to western New York. His family was large, consisting of 9 or 10 children, among whom Joe Jr. was the 3rd or 4th in succession. We have never been able to learn that any of the family were ever noted for much else than ignorance and stupidity, to which might be added, so far as it may respect the elder branch, a propensity to superstition and a fondness for everything marvelous. The latter characterization refers to the spiritual enthusiasms of the Smith parents, particularly the prophet's mother, Lucy Mack Smith. "Lucy had a vigorous but unschooled mind," observed Fawn Brody in No Man Knows My History, her magnificent, contentious biography of Joseph Smith. Lucy especially was devoted to the mysticism so often found among those suddenly released from the domination and discipline of a church. She accepted a highly personalized God to whom she would talk as if he were a member of the family circle. Her religion was intimate and homely, with God a ubiquitous presence invading dreams, provoking miracles, and blighting sinners' fields. Young Joseph's theological proclivities clearly owed much to Lucy, and just as clearly, both mother and son were hugely influenced by the tenor of the times. Following the Revolutionary War, the new republic was jarred by a period of ecclesiastical turmoil, during which the established churches were viewed by a large segment of the populace as spiritually bankrupt. The flood of religious experimentation that roiled the United States during the first decades of the 19th century, christened the Second Great Awakening, was roughly analogous to the religious upheaval that swept the country in the 1970s, absent the patchouli and LSD. In the early 1800s, the ferment was especially strong near the nation's expanding frontiers, including western New York, where the religious fervor flared with such intensity that the area around Palmyra became known as the Burnt-Over District. People imagined the acrid scent of brimstone in the air. The apocalypse seemed just around the corner. Never in the history of Western society had the millennium seemed so imminent, the Mormon historian Hiram L. Andrus has written. Never before had people looked so longingly and hopefully for its advent. It was expected that 20 years or less would see the dawn of that peaceful era. It was in this superheated, anything-goes religious climate that Joseph Smith gave birth to what would become America's most successful homegrown faith. An earnest, good-natured kid with a low boredom threshold, Joseph Jr. had no intention of becoming a debt-plagued farmer like his father, toiling in the dirt year in and year out. His talents called for a much grander arena. Although he received no more than a few years of formal schooling as a boy, by all accounts he possessed a nimble mind and an astonishingly fecund imagination. Like many autodidacts, he was drawn to the big questions. He spent long hours reflecting on the nature of the divine, pondering the meaning of life and death, assessing the merits and shortcomings of the myriad competing faiths of the day. Gregarious, athletic, and good-looking, he was a natural raconteur whom both men and women found immensely charming. His enthusiasm was infectious. He could sell a muzzle to a dog. The line separating religion from superstition can be indistinct, and this was especially true during the theological chaos of the Second Great Awakening, in which Joseph came of age. The future prophet's spiritual curiosity moved him to explore far and wide on both sides of that blurry line, including an extended foray into the necromantic arts. More specifically, he devoted much time and energy to attempting to divine the location of buried treasure by means of black magic and crystal gazing, activities he learned from his father. Several years later, he would renounce his dabbling in the occult, but Joseph's flirtation with folk magic as a young man had a direct and unmistakable bearing on the religion he would soon usher forth. Although money digging, as the custom was known, was illegal, it was nevertheless a common practice among the hoi polloi of New England and upstate New York. The woods surrounding Palmyra were riddled with Indian burial mounds that held ancient bones and artifacts, some of which were crafted from precious or semi-precious metals. It therefore comes as no surprise that a boy with Joseph's hyperactive mind and dreamy nature would hatch schemes to get rich by unearthing the gold rumored to be buried in the nearby hills and fields. Joseph's money digging began in earnest a few months shy of his 14th birthday, 2 years after his family's arrival in Palmyra, when he heard about the divining talents of a girl named Sally Chase, who lived near the Smith family farm. Upon learning that she possessed a magical rock, a peep stone or seer stone that allowed her to see anything, however hidden from others, Joseph harangued his parents until they let him pay the girl a visit. Sally's peepstone turned out to be a small, greenish rock. She placed it in the bottom of an upturned hat, then instructed Joseph to bury his face in the hat so as to exclude the light. When he did so, he was treated to magical visions. One of the things that appeared to him was a pocket-sized, white-colored stone a great way off. It became luminous and dazzled his eyes, and after a short time it became as intense as the midday sun. He immediately understood that this rock was another peepstone. The vision also indicated its precise location underground beneath a small tree. Joseph located the tree, started digging, and, with some labor and exertion, unearthed the first of at least three peepstones he would possess in his lifetime. His career as a scryer, that is to say, a diviner or crystal gazer, was launched. Soon his necromantic skills were sufficiently in demand that he was able to command respectable fees to find buried treasure for property owners throughout the region. By 1825, his renown was such that an elderly farmer named Josiah Stowell came from Pennsylvania to meet Joseph, and was so impressed by the encounter that he hired the 20-year-old to travel with him to the Susquehanna Valley to locate, with his peepstones, a hidden load of silver rumored to have been mined by the Spaniards centuries earlier. Stowell paid Joseph the generous salary of $14 a month for his services, more than the monthly wage earned by workers on the Erie Canal, plus room and board. These and other details of Joseph's money digging were revealed in affidavits and other documents generated by a trial held in March 1826, People of the State of New York versus Joseph Smith, in which the young scryer was hauled into court and found guilty of being a disorderly person and an impostor. Although Joseph had applied himself to scrying with vigor, dedication, and the finest tools of his trade, it seems that he had been unable to find Stowell's silver mine. Nor, in fact, during the previous 6 years he had worked as a money digger, had he ever managed to unearth any other actual treasure. When this had come to light, a disgruntled client had filed a legal claim accusing Joseph of being a fraud. The trial and the raft of bad press it generated brought his career as a professional diviner to an abrupt halt. He insisted to his numerous critics that he would mend his ways and abandon scrying forever. Only 18 months later, however, peepstones and black magic would again loom large in Joseph's life. Just down the road from his Palmyra home, he would finally discover a trove of buried treasure, and the impact of what he unearthed has been reverberating through the country's religious and political landscape ever since. One night in the autumn of 1823, when Joseph was 17, ethereal light filled his bedroom, followed by the appearance of an angel, who introduced himself as Moroni, and explained that he had been sent by God. He had come to tell Joseph of a sacred text inscribed on solid gold plates that had been buried 1,400 years earlier under a rock on a nearby hillside. Moroni then conjured a vision in Joseph's mind, showing him the exact place the plates were hidden. The angel cautioned the boy, however, that he shouldn't show the plates to anyone, or try to enrich himself from them, or even attempt to retrieve them yet. The next morning, Joseph walked to the hill that had appeared to him in the vision, quickly located the distinctive rock in question, dug beneath it, and unearthed a box constructed from 5 flat stones cemented together with mortar. Inside the box were the golden plates. In the excitement of the moment, however, he forgot Moroni's admonition that the time for bringing them forth had not yet arrived. When Joseph tried to remove the plates, they immediately vanished into the ether, and he was hurled violently to the ground. He later confessed that greed had gotten the better of him, adding, "Therefore I was chastened by the angel." Moroni was nevertheless willing to give Joseph another chance to prove his worthiness. The angel commanded the boy to return to the same place each year on September 22nd. Joseph dutifully obeyed, and every September he was visited by Moroni on what would later be named the Hill Cumorah to receive instruction about the golden plates and what God intended for him to do with them. On each occasion, Joseph left empty-handed, to his great disappointment. During their annual meeting in 1826, though, Moroni gave him reason for renewed hope. The angel announced that if Joseph would do right according to the will of God, he might obtain the plates the 22nd day of September next, and if not, he never would have them. By gazing into his most reliable peepstone, Joseph further learned that in order for him to be given the plates, God required that he marry a girl named Emma Hale and bring her along on his next visit to the hill in September 1827. Emma was a winsome neighbor of Josiah Stowell's in Pennsylvania, whom Joseph had met a year earlier while searching fruitlessly for the silver mine on Stowell's property. During that initial encounter, Emma and Joseph had felt a strong spark of mutual attraction, and he made several trips to the Hale home to ask for her hand in marriage. On each occasion, Emma's father, Isaac Hale, strenuously objected, citing Joseph's disreputable past as a money digger. Mr. Hale pointed out to his love-struck daughter that only a few months earlier, young Joe Smith had been convicted of fraud in a court of law. Joseph grew despondent over Hale's dogged refusal to let Emma marry him, and desperate. September was fast approaching. If he and Emma weren't betrothed by then, Maroney would withhold the golden plates from him forever. Borrowing a horse and sleigh from a fellow scryer, Joseph made one more trip to Pennsylvania, and on January 18, 1827, he persuaded Emma to defy her father, run away with him, and elope. 8 months later, shortly after midnight on the appointed day, Joseph and Emma went to the Hill Camorra. After being denied the plates on his previous four visits, this time Joseph left nothing to chance. Carefully adhering to the time-honored rituals of necromancy, the young couple were dressed entirely in black and had traveled the 3 miles from the Smith farm to the hill in a black carriage drawn by a black horse. High on the steep west slope of the hill, Joseph again dug beneath the rock in the dark of night, while Emma stood nearby with her back turned to him. He soon unearthed the stone box that he had been prevented from removing 4 years earlier. This time, however, Maroney allowed him to take temporary possession of its contents. The box contained a sacred text, written on golden plates, giving an account of the former inhabitants of this continent, which had been hidden on the hill for 1,400 years. Each of the gold pages on which this sacred narrative was inscribed, Joseph reported, was 6 inches wide and 8 inches long, and not quite as thick as common tin. They were filled with engravings in Egyptian characters and bound together in a volume as the leaves of a book with 3 rings running through the whole. The stack of metal pages stood about 6 inches high. Joseph gathered up the plates and headed home with them. Later, 19 witnesses would testify that they had actually seen the gold book. As 8 of them swore jointly in an affidavit printed in the Book of Mormon, "Joseph has shown unto us the plates, which have the appearance of gold, and we did handle with our hands. And we also saw the engravings thereon, all of which has the appearance of ancient work and of curious workmanship." Although the text was written in an exotic, long-dead language described as Reformed Egyptian, Maroney had also given Joseph a set of interpreters, divinely endowed spectacles that would allow the person wearing them to comprehend the strange hieroglyphics. By means of these magic glasses, Joseph began deciphering the document, dictating his translation to a neighbor named Martin Harris, who acted as his scribe. After 2 months of painstaking work, they completed the first 116 pages of translation, at which point the two men took a break. Maroney retrieved the golden plates and magic spectacles, and Joseph reluctantly allowed Harris to borrow the manuscript to show his skeptical, disapproving wife. Disaster then struck. Harris somehow mislaid all 116 pages. The prevailing view is that his wife was so furious that Harris had gotten involved in such nonsense that she stole the pages and destroyed them. Whatever became of the vanished translation, Joseph was devastated when Harris confessed what had happened. "Oh my God," Joseph exclaimed, "all is lost." It looked like his sacred mission had come to a premature end, with nothing at all to show for it. In September 1828, however, after much praying and contrition on Joseph's part, Maroney returned the plates and the translation resumed, initially with Emma Smith serving as scribe. Later, others shared this duty as well. The 116 missing pages have never turned up. Some evidence suggests that prior to his conviction, Mark Hoffman, the forger who is now Dan Lafferty's cellmate at Point of the Mountain, had hatched a scheme to discover the long-lost text. Because Hoffman's forgery, taken at face value, would presumably have reflected poorly on Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon, the LDS Church would probably have paid him handsomely for the document, then hidden it in the president's vault with the other potentially embarrassing historical documents that church leaders have thus far managed to keep away from the prying eyes of scholars. But the angel hadn't returned the spectacles along with the plates this time around, so to decipher the Egyptian characters, Joseph relied instead on his favorite peepstone, a chocolate-colored, egg-shaped rock that he had discovered 24 feet underground in the company of Sally Chase's father while digging a well in 1822. Day after day, utilizing the technique he had learned from Sally, Joseph would place the magic rock in an upturned hat, bury his face in it with the stack of gold plates sitting nearby, and dictate the lines of scripture that appeared to him out of the blackness. He worked at a feverish pace during this second phase of the translation, averaging some 3,500 words a day, and by the end of June 1829, the job was finished. Joseph took the manuscript to the publisher of the local newspaper, the Palmyra-based Wayne Sentinel, and asked him to print and bind 5,000 copies of the book, an uncommonly large printing for a self-published volume by an unknown figure, which indicates that Joseph had giddy expectations for how it would be received by the public. He intended to charge $1.25 per copy. Not an exorbitant price by any means, but still about twice as much as most local wage earners made in a day. The skeptical publisher demanded $3,000 in advance to print the books, much more cash than Joseph could lay his hands on. As was his wont when confronted with an apparently insurmountable hurdle, he sought divine guidance. God announced in reply that it was his divine wish that Martin Harris, Joseph's acolyte and scribe, pay the printer's bill. Speaking through Joseph, God told Harris, "I command thee that thou shalt not covet thine own property, but impart it freely to the printing. And misery thou shalt receive if thou wilt slight these counsels, yea, even the destruction of thyself and property. Pay the printer's debt." Previously, Harris had usually been putty in Joseph's hands, but his involvement with the translation had already cost him dearly. His wife had grown so exasperated over his obsession with the Golden Bible that she'd divorced him. Harris thus balked at heeding the commandment when Joseph first presented it to him. In the end, however, a stern directive from God wasn't something Harris was prepared to ignore, so he reluctantly agreed to sell his farm in order to finance the publication. 9 months after the translation was completed, the 588-page book finally rolled off the presses and went on sale in the printer's brick storefront in downtown Palmyra. Little more than a week after that, on April 6, 1830, Joseph formally incorporated the religion that we know today as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The religion's foundation, its sacred touchstone and guiding scripture, was the translation of the gold plates, which bore the title, The Book of Mormon. Chapter 6. Cumorah. The authority that Mormonism promised rested not on the subtlety of its theology. It rested on an appeal to fresh experience, a set of witnessed golden tablets that had been translated into a book whose language sounded biblical. Joseph Smith instinctively knew what all other founders of new American religions in the 19th century instinctively knew. Many Americans of that period, in part because of popular enthusiasm for science, were ready to listen to any claim that appealed to something that could be interpreted as empirical evidence. R. Lawrence Moore, Religious Outsiders and the Making of Americans. Today, no less than in the 19th century, the Hill Cumorah is one of the holiest sites in all of Mormondom, and sooner or later most Latter-day Saints make a pilgrimage here. To a Utah Mormon accustomed to the 11,000-foot peaks of the Wasatch Front thrusting heavenward like the teeth of God over Temple Square and the City of the Saints, Cumorah's puny dimensions must come as something of a disappointment. A mound of glacial scrapings left behind after the last ice age, it humps up no more than a couple of 100 feet above the surrounding cornfields, and most of Cumorah is shrouded in a gloomy tangle of vegetation. All the same, this modest drumlin is the highest landform in the vicinity, and from its crest one can glimpse the office towers of downtown Rochester, 20 miles distant, shimmering through the midsummer haze. The summit is adorned with an American flag and an imposing statue of the angel Moroni. On the slope beneath Moroni's massive sandaled feet, the unruly forest has been cleared and a broad swath of the hillside planted with impeccably groomed bluegrass. Somewhere on this part of Cumorah, 175 years ago, Joseph Smith dug up the golden plates that launched the Mormon faith. It's a steamy evening in mid-July, and more than 10,000 saints are politely streaming into the meadow at the Drumlin's base, on which rows of plastic seats have been set up to accommodate them. Immediately above the meadow, a multi-level stage, half as big as a football field, covers the hill's lower apron, surrounded by a steel forest of 50-foot light towers. The elaborate stage, the lights, and the Mormon throngs all materialize here every summer for the Hill Cumorah pageant, America's Witness for Christ, which is due to begin at sunset. According to promotional materials published by the LDS Church, the pageant is America's largest and most spectacular outdoor theatrical event, a magnificent family-oriented production, replete with arresting special effects straight out of Hollywood. Volcanoes, fireballs, and explosions with sound effects from the movie Earthquake. A prophet is burned at the stake. Lightning strikes the mast of a ship. A 5,000K carbon arc light star with FAA clearance appears at the nativity scene. Christ appears in the night sky, descends, teaches the people, then ascends into the night sky and disappears. The pageant, which has been staged here since 1937, is held for 7 nights every July and draws near-capacity crowds each night. Admission is free. As dusk settles, the soothing harmonies of the Utah Symphony Orchestra and Mormon Tabernacle Choir drift over the field from concert loudspeakers. 2 squads of sheriff's deputies direct traffic into pastures that have been transformed into vast parking lots. A surging tide of saints is now moving from their cars and chartered buses toward the seats, and as they traverse Highway 21 to reach the meadow beneath Cumorah, they are confronted with grim-faced clumps of anti-Mormon picketers. The demonstrators, who belong to evangelical Christian denominations, wave hand-lettered placards and shout angrily at the Mormons, "Joseph Smith was a whoremonger. There is only one gospel. The Book of Mormon is a big fairy tale. Mormons are not Christians." Most of the Mormons stroll quietly past the ranting evangelicals, unperturbed, without rising to the bait. "Oh, gosh, we're used to that kind of thing," says Brother Richard, a wide, cheerful man with liver spots and a comb-over, who brags that he has 28 grandchildren. He and his wife drove here in a 37-foot Pace Arrow from Mesa, Arizona. This is their 8th visit to the pageant. "Come the judgment, we'll see who winds up in the celestial kingdom and who doesn't," Richard muses. "But just between you and me, them folks waving the signs is the ones that should be worried." As this thought escapes his lips, the glint in his eye momentarily vanishes, and his guileless face darkens with pity. The Lord allows everyone to choose for themselves whether to see the truth or ignore it. You can't force a man to heaven, even though it's for his own good. The LDS Church produces the Hill Cumorah pageant at no small expense. Although non-saints are encouraged to attend, and the church considers the flamboyant shows a powerful tool in its tireless efforts to convert the world, more than 95% of the people in attendance belong to the church already. Mostly the pageant functions as a Mormon jamboree, an occasion for members of the tribe to gather at their place of origin and celebrate one another's testimonies of faith. The pageant has the energy of a fish concert, but without the drunkenness, outlandish hairdos, Brother Richard's comb-over notwithstanding, or clouds of marijuana smoke. People started arriving hours ago to claim the best seats. While they wait for the show to start, families sprawl on blankets along the edges of the meadow, eating fried chicken and Jell-O salad from plastic coolers. Clean-cut teenagers shrieking gleefully toss frisbees and water balloons in the gloaming. Order, needless to say, prevails. This is a culture that considers obedience to be among the highest virtues. The sun finally skids behind the horizon in an ozone-enhanced blaze of orange. A scrubbed Mormon elder in his early 20s walks out and leads the audience in a heartfelt prayer. A few seconds after he finishes, there is a fanfare of trumpets, and lasers pierce the night sky with shafts of dazzling light. A thrill ripples through the crowd. Great billows of ersatz fog roll across lower Cumorah. Emerging from the mist, 627 actors march onto stage, costumed as a curious menage of biblical figures and pre-Columbian North Americans, some wearing headgear adorned with towering antlers. Suddenly a disembodied voice, a stern baritone that sounds like it could belong to God himself, thunders from the 75 loudspeakers. This is the true story of a people who were prepared by the Lord to be ready for the coming of the Savior Jesus Christ. He came to them in the Americas, but their story began in the Old World, in Jerusalem. For the next 2 hours, the rapt audience is treated to a dramatic reenactment of the Book of Mormon. The narrative inscribed on the golden plates, translated by Joseph Smith as the Book of Mormon, is the history of an ancient Hebrew tribe headed by a virtuous man named Lehi. In raising his large brood, Lehi drummed into the heads of his offspring that the most important thing in life is to earn God's love, and the one and only way to do that, he explained, is to obey the Lord's every commandment. Lehi and his followers abandoned Jerusalem 600 years before the birth of Christ, just ahead of the last Babylonian conquest, and journeyed to North America by boat. In the New World, alas, long simmering family jealousies flared. Lehi had always favored his youngest and most exemplary son, Nephi, so it shouldn't have surprised anybody when the old man bequeathed leadership of the tribe to him. Even abridged, the Book of Mormon is a fantastically complex story that requires no small effort to digest, and the names of the protagonists do not always lodge easily in the non-Mormon memory. But an attempt to recall Moroni and Nephi will be rewarded later in this book, for both these fabled personages figure in the modern saga of Dan Lafferty. But this infuriated Nephi's miscreant brother Laman, causing the tribe to split into two rival clans after Lehi's passing. The righteous, fair-skinned Nephites, led by Nephi, and their bitter adversaries, the Lamanites, as the followers of Laman were known. The Lamanites were an idle people, full of mischief and subtlety, whose behavior was so annoying to God that he cursed the whole lot of them with dark skin to punish them for their impiety. Shortly after the resurrection of Christ, according to the Book of Mormon, Jesus visited North America to share his new gospel with the Nephites and Lamanites, and to persuade the two clans to quit squabbling. Heeding his message, for several hundred years they united amicably as Christians and prospered. But then the Lamanites began to backslide into unbelief and idolatry. An unbridgeable rift developed between the clans, and they fought each other with escalating violence. Tensions continued to build, eventually sparking a full-blown war that culminated around A.D. 400 with a brutal campaign in which the reprobate Lamanites slaughtered all 230,000 of the Nephites, which explains why Columbus encountered no Caucasians when he landed in the New World in 1492. Facing starvation, the handful of Nephite children clinging to life at war's end were forced to cannibalize the flesh of dead family members. But in the end, they too succumbed. The victorious Lamanites survived to become the ancestors of the modern American Indians, although eventually these red sons of Israel lost all memory of both the Nephites and their Judaic heritage. The leader of the Nephites during their final doomed battles had been a heroic figure of uncommon wisdom named Mormon. The last Nephite to survive the genocidal wrath of the Lamanites was Mormon's son Moroni, whose account of the Nephites' demise makes up the final chapter of the Book of Mormon. This same Moroni would return as an angel 14 centuries later to deliver the golden plates to Joseph Smith, so that the blood-soaked history of his people could be shared with the world and thereby affect the salvation of mankind. The Book of Mormon has been much derided by non-Mormons since before it was even published. Critics point out that the gold plates, which would presumably prove the book's authenticity, were conveniently returned to Moroni after Joseph completed his translation, and they haven't been seen since. Scholars have observed that no archaeological artifacts with links to the supposedly advanced and widespread Nephite civilization have ever been found in North America or anywhere else. As history, moreover, the Book of Mormon is riddled with egregious anachronisms and irreconcilable inconsistencies. For instance, it makes many references to horses and wheeled carts, neither of which existed in the Western Hemisphere during the pre-Columbian era. It inserts such inventions as steel and the seven-day week into ancient history long before such things were in fact invented. Modern DNA analysis has conclusively demonstrated that American Indians are not descendants of any Hebraic race, as the Lamanites were purported to be. Mark Twain famously ridiculed the Book of Mormon's tedious quasi-biblical prose as chloroform in print, observing that the phrase, "and it came to pass," is used more than 2,000 times. But such criticism and mockery are largely beside the point. All religious belief is a function of non-rational faith, and faith, by its very definition, tends to be impervious to intellectual argument or academic criticism. Polls routinely indicate, moreover, that 9 out of 10 Americans believe in God. Most of us subscribe to one brand of religion or another. Those who would assail the Book of Mormon should bear in mind that its veracity is no more dubious than the veracity of the Bible, say, or the Quran, or the sacred texts of most other religions. The latter texts simply enjoy the considerable advantage of having made their public debut in the shadowy recesses of the ancient past, and are thus much harder to refute. In any case, like a movie that is panned by New York critics yet goes on to become a huge blockbuster in the hinterlands, the tremendous popularity of the Book of Mormon makes it impossible to dismiss. The sheer quantity of copies in print, at last count over 100 million, lends the book a certain gravitas, even among cynics. The numbers speak eloquently to the book's power as a sacred symbol and its raw narrative force. The simple truth is, the Book of Mormon tells a story that multitudes have found compelling, and continue to find compelling as the swarms who flock to the Hill Cumorah pageant every July attest. In early 19th century America, vestiges of a previous civilization, ruins such as the many Indian burial mounds near Joseph's home, were everywhere. The Book of Mormon explained the origins of these ancient tumuli in a way that dovetailed neatly with both Christian scripture and a theory then in wide circulation, which posited that the American Indians were descended from the lost tribes of Israel. Joseph's book worked both as theology and as a literal history of the New World. To an awful lot of people, the story makes perfect sense. Joseph began winning converts almost immediately after he received the plates from Moroni, well before the book was printed and made public. The excitement conveyed by Martin Harris, Joseph's parents and siblings, and others who swore they had actually seen and hefted the Golden Bible, convinced their friends and associates to become Mormonites, as the Latter-day Saints were initially called. When the Mormon Church was formally established in April 1830, it claimed some 50 members. A year later, the membership exceeded 1,000, and fresh converts were arriving all the time. Suitably awed that God had chosen Joseph to receive the gold plates, converts had no trouble believing his assertion that his new religion was the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, or that the Book of Mormon was an essential update to both the Old Testament and the New Testament. They were taught that it was an even newer testament which provided a more accurate and complete account of sacred history. Joseph explained that in the first century after the crucifixion of Jesus, the Christian leadership had taken a wrong theological turn and had led the church astray. Calling this blunder the Great Apostasy, he divulged that virtually all Christian doctrine that had developed thereafter, Catholic and Protestant alike, was a whopping lie. Fortunately, the Book of Mormon would set the record straight and restore the true Church of Christ. There was an appealing simplicity to the book's central message, which framed existence as an unambiguous struggle between good and evil. There are two churches only. The one is the church of the Lamb of God, and the other is the church of the devil. Wherefore, whoso belongeth not to the church of the Lamb of God belongeth to that great church, which is the mother of abominations. The Book of Mormon appealed as well because it was so thoroughly American. Most of its narrative was set on the American continent. In one of the book's most important moments, Jesus Christ pays a special visit to the New World immediately after his resurrection to tell his chosen people, residents of what would become America, the good news. Moroni delivers the golden plates to a quintessentially American prophet, Joseph, who later receives a revelation in which God lets it be known that the Garden of Eden had been located in America. And when it is time for Jesus to return to earth, he assures Joseph, the Son of Man will be making his glorious arrival in that same corner of America. But perhaps the greatest attraction of Mormonism was the promise that each follower would be granted an extraordinarily intimate relationship with God.